You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good evening. Excuse me. Good evening. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programming at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. It's a pleasure to see you all here, well, to be here this evening. The Library Foundation of Los Angeles is a nonprofit organization that provides vital support to the Los Angeles Public Library. We present various programs, including the Aloud series. This evening, we would like to thank all of our supporters, especially our Library Foundation members, who make it possible to bring this type of programming to you. If you would like to learn more about the Library Foundation, please visit lfla.org/support. Your membership can make a difference in the lives of many Angelenos. Tonight, this is the second in the Aloud series focused on power and value. My hope in conceiving this series was to explore the complexities of how these two dynamic concepts affect who and what matters in our society. This evening, this evening, we're focusing on the power of the press. The press's role in providing facts and shaping opinion, exposing us to the truths we may never know. It's clear that a free press is a central part of our democracy. The press, when it does what it should, speaks truth to power. It uncovers corruption, excesses, and falsities that exist within our government and within big business. We're very fortunate this evening to have three prominent journalists and a media expert to discuss these issues. Yamiche Alcindor is a journalist for PBS News, Hour, and a political contributor to NBC and MSNBC News. Before becoming a television journalist, she was at the New York Times, a reporter at New York Times, and a reporter for USA Today. Brooke Gladstone is a journalist, author, and media analyst. She is the co-host and managing editor of WNYC program on the media. Sewell Chen currently serves as the editorial page editor at the LA Times, where he oversees the editorial board and the op-ed and Sunday opinion pages. Prior to the LA Times, he worked at the New York Times and the Washington Post. Moderating tonight's discussion is Hector Amaya, a professor at the Annenberg School at USC of Communication. He has written three books and has published numerous articles on immigration, on globalization, and Latin America media. Welcome to our guests and to our audience. Please enjoy tonight's program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica. I am Hector Amaya, and it is an honor to be with you today, and an honor to be with this extraordinary group of professional journalists. We have something in common, you know. But I fear that long are the days that your profession and my profession, journalism and the academy, played an outsized role as arbiters of the factual. Today, we have powerful competition. In addition to the troubling role of echo chambers, we have influencers, professional fake newsmakers, computer bots, international efforts to weaponize misinformation. Now, in regular times, trust in the news is necessary, but in times of crisis, I think we need this trust even much more. But that is not what we have right now, not in this society. And the idea is to talk about it today. Let's start with Brooke. Brooke, in your latest book, you write that facts, even a lot of facts, do not constitute reality. Reality is what forms after we filter, arrange, and prioritize those facts and marinate them in our values and traditions. Reality is personal.
Right.
Now, these are powerful and complex words, by the way, but I wonder how you function as a media maker, as a newsmaker, knowing this, having this knowledge, having this sense of reality.
It's an observation that that all of us can easily make. I mean, there are bits and pieces, and then we build our own worldview like a bunch of Lego blocks, you know, with an erector set. And the thing that we fear the most is that structure will be shattered. And that is, for many people, what maybe most Americans is what's happened over the last few years. Those of us who were complacent or didn't feel the need to see, suddenly see what the nation is and what needs to be fixed. Reality is absolutely personal. And that is what's caused, I think, so much distress, because we don't live where we thought we lived. And it's our job, I think, to examine the layers of what we believed to be true and what appears to be true and what is most likely to be true.
Thank you, Luke. Yeah, and these are difficult ideas, by the way. I lose sleep over them. Yamish, I was wondering, you know, whether you can add a little bit, especially because your job takes you at the center of the war over truth. Tell us your experience about being a White House correspondent in this administration and the relationship to truth.
Well, I think Brooke made a really smart point, which is that we all sort of filter reality and truth based on our own lived experiences. So I think we're living in a time period where the very nature of truth is being questioned by politicians, by the presidency, by members of both sides of the aisle in terms of Democrats and Republicans. And I think as being a White House correspondent, I find myself in this interesting position where I'm fact-checking and presenting truth, but I'm also understanding that people all over this country are looking at the work that I'm doing and making their own decisions on whether or not they believe it. And I think for me as a reporter, the most important thing is to bring a sort of truth that illuminates the vulnerabilities of Americans and kind of gives voice to the people who may never walk into the White House. So my goal as a reporter has always been to really highlight the civil rights issues of our time, whether it be race, whether it be gender, whether it be the LGBTQ community and their struggles, or whether it be simple facts that are true related right now, of course, to the pandemic and all the things that we've seen happen in this administration. So I think that when I think about my experience as a White House correspondent, I think I'm very lucky to be kind of grounded in this idea that of thinking of myself as a civil rights journalist, because I think that it makes me not overly concerned about how people will filter the things that I report, because I know as a Black woman of Haitian descent that just by the fact that I'm saying the news in a brown body with curly hair, that might telegraph to people something that they think they know about me. When in fact they don't, they might not really actually know that, and that might not be true. So I think I'm very aware of the fact that I'm doing this body and I'm doing this work in a body that I think at times telegraphs messages to people and influences how they see my work.
So the reality is personal, as Brooke suggests, and you are reminding us also that the personal also shapes reality. We are embodied in a certain way, and truth that comes from our mouths has certain value and propensity to be believed or not, depending on the context. So I'm curious about your job as opinion editor at the LA Times, which I find super difficult. I think you must deal with all sorts of situations in which your idea of balance and trust has to be at issue and and perhaps on a daily basis. Can you tell us a little bit about how what it feels to be in that spot?
Sure. Thank you, Hector, and thank you to the nearly 200 attendees giving us part of your Wednesday evening. It's really an inspiration to virtually connect with so many engaged Angelenos and Southern Californians at this time of great pain and turmoil. I've been editorial page editor for about 3 months, and actually I'll make a little bit of a tiny announcement tonight. I'm not sure if we'll get tweeted, but we'll have to take the risk. We are going to announce our endorsement for president tomorrow. And, you know, it's my first time going through such a process. I won't give it away, but I will talk about a process that we went through of really looking at the Los Angeles Times' history, which I think speaks to this question. You know, I've only been in this institution for 2 years, but I'm very heartened that we are asking questions that needed to be asked, you know, many, many years ago. Who gets to tell the stories, and for whom are the stories told? And, you know, we've tried to orient the Los Angeles Times really fully and firmly as a California-facing, California-centered organization. We've also had to look at the past and who the LA Times stood for. One of the things that I learned in my research is that the Los Angeles Times endorsed Republicans exclusively from its founding in 1881 all the way up through 1972. And then it went through a 36-year hiatus of not endorsing anyone. And then since 2008, the paper has endorsed Democrats. But I think the more relevant question is not the partisan side of it, but really what you get at with trust. You know, I believe that institutions like the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times, where Yamiche and I once worked, you know, are really, really important safeguards of our democracy, as are NPR and PBS. I do worry about the extent to which kind of institutional voices and institutional credibility still carry weight. I think we're in a mixed world right now. I don't think that these institutions have been completely devalued, but let's face it, they've been weakened somewhat. It's no longer good enough to say, you know, this is what we recommend because the Los Angeles Times says so. What does that mean? I try in our process to explain who are the editorial board members of the Los Angeles Times. I try to explain the distinction between news and opinion. I try to make sure that our editorials express a certain set of values that have stayed steady over time, certainly in recent time. And that also we don't speak for the newsroom journalists. You know, we can make recommendations. That's part of a newspaper's legacy. But our journalists, our reporters are carrying their work out on an impartial and neutral basis. And I think that's a really important part in terms of, you know, reaffirming and maintaining trust.
You raised a very important point, Sewell, the issue of transparency as being a part of the business of news and a necessary part in order to convey who we are as newsmakers, as media makers, and why should we be trusted. And in a different way, actually, Yamiche actually did the same when you are pointing out that you have a perspective, you have a position, we have our upbringings that actually shape the way that we understand reality. I wonder if you actually have other ideas about transparency that can be carried out actually day in, day out. This is for all of you, Brooke, Yamiche, Sewell. How is it that transparency actually is coming to perhaps help and sometimes even fortify and sometimes even supplant the idea of unbiased?
Will you allow me to start with one thought? I think the word objectivity has become a very, very contested word. In many ways, it has long been contested. I think in its kind of most naked form, the idea that any of us has a view from nowhere and that, you know, we're just kind of, you know, disembodied minds, you know, gathering news, probably not socially realistic or accurate. I would say over the 20 years I've been a journalist, there's been a shift toward an emphasis on fairness, mm-hmm. accuracy, independence, and neutrality. But that doesn't mean objectivity. You know, we're in a time that very, very much where false equivalency is constantly criticized, where proportion matters as much as fact. In other words, it's not enough to say what happened, or Trump said this, Biden says that, but adding the context, actually, you know, referring to, you know, reliable and truthful sources. And I think we have to be more transparent about who we are, who funds us. In the case of NPR and PBS, the sources of public funding, which are great. In our case, we're blessed to have a local owner here in Los Angeles as of 2 years ago, who your journalists are. I firmly believe we need to have more journalistic bios. We need to say who we are. people may then, you know, as Yamiche said, very, very, you know, strikingly, people may make judgments on us based on our gender, our race, et cetera. We can't help that. What we can do is be transparent about our methods and speak with precision and factual accuracy, but also make sure that we're attentive to the painful truth that public trust in institutions has been on the decline for decades. And the media is one of these institutions. Now, there's a lot of blame to be pointed, and we can get into that. But the fact is, as the Pew Research Center recently showed, Americans are very, very skeptical of the news media. I think part of the way that we overcome that skepticism is by being fully transparent about who we are.
Yeah, transparency is the new objectivity. Nobody really believes in objectivity anymore. Right after the election, my co-host and I pretty much had a fight on the radio, and we edited it down for time and just aired it, you know? So it was, you know, it was our editorial meeting, essentially. We're still hearing about that almost every day, just because it was such a naked and raw demonstration of what goes on every day. The whole issue, I mean, everything that Sewell said, I completely agree with. Fairness and accuracy are what matter now, not objectivity. I'm not certain what the word neutrality actually means, because some of the greatest journalism in American history, back in the days of the muckrakers, was done with an immense stake in the outcome, but the civil rights movement
and the Vietnam era.
Yeah. Right. And it was, but the journalism was flawless, and that's what makes the difference. And yeah, in terms of judgment, there was a great study some years back where they took a bunch of articles and labeled one Fox and labeled one NPR. And, especially, I have to say, this effect was more pronounced on the right than on the left, but it was on the left as well, that when you got down to things like fun travel spots and recipes, partisans would still believe one site over the other, the identical article. So there really isn't any way around it. You are what you are, and in a way, you just have to report the most honestly and fairly according to your values, because we aren't some sort of tribe of passionless priests. We are human beings.
And I would add to that I think you've seen that shift in the industry. You see a lot of stories now, especially after 2016, but even before that, listing that this article is the product of 18 interviews. Bob Woodward talking about the fact that even today with the news breaking on his new book, Rage, that he had hours of interviews with the president. I think that tells people that journalism isn't just people waking up and deciding I'm going to talk to two people and then do a story, that there's real work that goes into the journalism, and that it's on journalists to be able to explain to people, here's what it took to get this story. I think that that's critical. I think it's a service. I think journalism has also always, at least since I've been in it, has always been this place that is transparent when we make mistakes. So that's why you see corrections at the bottom of stories. I think that tells people that we're not people that are flawless, that we are able to admit our mistakes. I once had a typo during a live tweet in Ferguson where I was spelling the governor's name wrong. And I said, I'm sorry, I was relying on autocorrect. I think if you're not transparent with people, then you don't really understand that there are human beings doing this work. At the same time, I think I try to tell people, most people that go into journalism, they go into journalism to tell the truth, to really do a service to the American people. And most of the journalists that I've met, that's their goal. Their goal is to tell stories in a way that impacts the country and that challenges people's thinking and that reveals and educates. So I think it's good to also explain to people, well, how did you become a journalist? Why did you become a journalist? What does it mean to be a journalist? I think all of those things are things that we've had to really explain to people more and more as the years have gone on. And I think that transparency is key. I also agree with everything that Brooke and Sewell said about kind of objectivity. I think as someone who covers the White House and has covered race for a long time, I can tell people I think racism is wrong. I think Black people should not be getting killed at higher rates than white people, that there's not anything inherently criminal about having a Black body. I think that those are things that I can say with no qualms, because I believe that that's the society we should be living in, one where we are treated equally as Americans and as human beings moving around in the world globally. So I think that that to me are just the baseline things that I operate from, understanding that I think that people should have equal access to schools, that people should be able to really pursue the American dream in the real sense and not be kind of not be imprisoned by their surroundings or their race or their gender. And I think that those are the things that I think people will get from my reporting anyways, but they're things that I'm happy to also explain to people. Yeah, these are the things that are driving me and motivating me as a White House reporter.
Thank you, Yamiche. And I'm a professional educator, you know, and I work in the School of Communication and Journalism at an American USC. And we train journalists all the time. And what you were saying, Yamiche, reminded me, you know, of something that keeps me, forces me to reflect actually on your profession, which is the fact that actually right now journalists are routinely bullied, harassed, and there seems to be a changing mood in the nation as to the even the safety of journalists, where actually seems to be more condoned to actually be violent and aggressive to a journalist. And I was wondering how do you feel as a journalist, you know, having to do this job? How do you relate to your profession? How would you motivate young people to follow your steps, you know, and what moves you forward?
So I should say, for me, I became a journalist because I learned of the story of Emmett Till. He was a 14-year-old boy who was murdered in Mississippi. He was falsely accused of trying to flirt with a white woman and was killed by adult white men. And I think that story, that idea that a Black boy, a Black person can be criminalized and murdered in this country, and that there can be really be no consequences to that, really drove me to understanding the civil rights movement and drove me to understand all the people who put their lives on the line so that someone like me could be in the world and be pursuing my dreams. So it's not lost on me that in the pursuit of all of the human rights that African Americans fought in the 1960s, that there were, of course, people that were killed, Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, so many others. And I think for me, that is the level of passion and focus that I think of in my journalism, that it's the thing that I do and that wakes me up every morning, because it's the thing that I feel like is my purpose, is my goal. So I don't focus too much on harassment or what people say about me or what the profession has become or has to become in terms of the people's receptions to it, because I think at the end of the day my focus is to tell the truth. And I tell that to young people who are interested in journalism, I think do the thing that you're passionate about. So for me, I was never passionate about entertainment journalism. There's great entertainment journalists out there. There are great people who are doing stories about celebrities and Black Hollywood and all sorts of things. But for me, my focus was on poor people. It was on politics. It was on policies. It was on education, things that impact people's daily struggles and survival. And for me, that's what I think keeps me going every day. And when I think about journalists and young journalists that want to come through the industry, I tell them, don't be motivated by money, because obviously this is an industry that I think we all can agree on. There's a lot of other things you can do if you want to be rich, and this isn't one of them per se. So I think it's also about focusing on, well, what do you really want to get out of this? And be ready to struggle, because for me, I wanted to go back to Miami when I graduated so badly and I couldn't get a job. I graduated in 2009 when the market had just crashed. There were no jobs, and I went from internship to internship to internship for a long time, but I figured it out. And I think that there's a lot of times where people want to pursue journalism but are really afraid, because the industry has changed a whole lot. So I think that's my advice for young people, especially, is find a group of people who are willing to cheer you on. Find someone that you might have to live with, like me. I lived with my friend's grandma for a couple months after college because I frankly could not afford an apartment on my own. So I think it is about really focusing on your goals and pressing forward no matter what. I always said after I graduated, my parents being Haitian immigrants, they were pushing me to be a lawyer. And I knew I would be miserable. And I knew I would be even more miserable if I ended up becoming a lawyer and got laid off, which is what happened a lot of times after the market crash. So I think really being able to steel yourself and be ready to even tell the people that love you the most that this is what you want to do. That was how I got to be where I am.
Thank you, Yamisha. Brooke, so?
You want the story of how I got into journalism? It feels so last century that it almost doesn't matter. I can tell you, though, that after Trump was elected and there was so much despair, friends of ours, also journalists, sent an email saying, do you feel like you've been waiting 30 years for a moment to really matter? It was a fairly, no period in American history is normal, but compared to now, the periods that I reported through seem fairly orderly, only in retrospect, certainly not at the time. But I am motivated by the fact that the work never seems to have mattered more than now. We're at a moment where something can really change, when people's eyes are finally being open. At least the people who are reachable are willing to see. And that is a rare opportunity, not one that I've seen very often. And that's what motivates me now in a way that I hadn't felt for a very long time.
All I'd add to go back to your question, Hector, was it would be the international and comparative perspective. I think journalists like Yamiche and Brooke, especially who are public facing, who are broadcasters, have to have so much courage. And I really salute you both, because I'm just a writer. It's a little bit more behind the scenes. But I also think what's happening overseas is so terrifying. I want to give a shout out to my friend Maria Ressa, who has been detained numerous times in the Philippines for the courageous investigative journalism of her outlet, The Rappler. I want to give a shout out to my colleague at the Los Angeles Times, Alice Su, who was recently, just a few days ago, detained by Chinese authorities as she was traveling to Inner Mongolia to write about the loss of the Mongol language as more and more people are kind of compelled to speak Mandarin and learn Mandarin. And we've protested her detention. Based on my relationships and what I read from Committee to Protect Journalists and Pan America and Freedom House, I think this is going to be an intergenerational and transnational struggle for freedom of the press, freedom of expression, human dignity. And I think we need to look at things in a comparative fashion. I am not saying, of course, that President Trump is Leninist. But when he uses a phrase like enemy of the people that was used by Lenin, who did silence dissent in a radically different society and social system, it troubles me. Ben Smith said recently, he's a media critic for the New York Times, said recently, journalists are not here to be your friend. I think that is true at the level of sources. We're here to report. We're not here to be buddy-buddy. But I do think that in the philosophical sense, we should be a friend of the people as the press, of the people at large. We should be a friend of democracy. We should be a friend of human rights and rule of law. Because in fact, our own craft, our own creed is based on the First Amendment, is based on the fact that we are the only private form of private enterprise in the United States explicitly singled out for protection in our nation's basic law. And I think that's important to remember that. This isn't a European country where there are like journalism boards that kind of set regulations. American journalism has traditionally been largely commercial and self-regulated. We can discuss the business model, which is another huge topic. But I think part of the, with the privilege that we have expressed, especially under laws regarding libel, which is very hard to prove in America, with the privilege and the power come the responsibility and the duty. And I think that journalism is, I hope, turning toward a more morally and ethically clear era, as writers like Wesley Lowery have called for.
So I'm sorry.
I was going to say, you know, you have to write for your times. Morals are a moving target. I mean, there was a time in the American press where slavery was debatable, when the internment of Japanese Americans was celebrated, when women not having the right to vote was also highly contentious. In the end, you have to let, forget about gay marriage, right? That happened so recently. But these things shift. You have to make your best choice. You have to think hard about, you know, how history will judge you. And I don't mean that I will be noticed by history, but I mean, I have to report according to some value system. I'm not an algorithm or a computer. And so, and that was something that, especially in the mid-century, was regarded as wrong, as poor journalism. My husband will be answering that phone any second. Okay, my apologies. But in any case, that is American journalism has only for a very short period, if you look through it historically, ever even pretended to objectivity. And that was partly a business decision. It was a deal they had with government because it happened exactly when media became more expensive rather than cheaper and cheaper and cheaper as it had. When television came in, objectivity became the watchword. So we're talking about not that long. And now that it's cheaper again, objectivity, so-called, is no longer necessary.
I would just add to what Brooke said about kind of how history will judge you. I think I'm more so, especially during the pandemic, I think a lot of us are reflecting, and I mean a lot of us, meaning Americans, but also journalists, are really reflecting on, for me personally, the idea of life and death, the idea of legacy, the idea of how fragile us all being and living in this time is. Having looked so deeply at the death tolls in this pandemic, I think I'm so aware of the idea that like history is watching us all. I love Hamilton, but really I feel like history has its eye on all of us. And I think that when I look at my grandkids, if I'm blessed to have grandkids, I want to be able to tell them I did what I felt was right in that moment. And of course that's tied to PBS, that's tied to journalism, but really it's, for me, it's tied to life and death. It's tied to my humanity. And when I think of what I want to look to the next generation and explain to them, I don't want to be telling them that I sugarcoated things to make people comfortable and that I said things that weren't true just because it would help me get ahead. I don't ever want to think that. I want to think that I was standing on what I believe to be the right side of history.
Thank you, Yamish. Time is moving forward very fast. But I have to ask you this question about the context also. Right now, you know, we are in the middle of COVID, is still suffering as a nation because of it. We are in the middle of this reckoning with racial justice that is powerful and that is infiltrating every aspect of society. And then in the middle of these two great moments, difficult moments, we have an election. As journalists, what is keeping you awake at night?
Probably the same thing that's keeping everybody who cares enough to be watching this awake at night. You know, what will be the future of our democracy? Will we seize this moment to create a fairer, more equitable society? Will we finally have a reckoning with our white supremacist past and present? You know, these things, this encounter with history, if we don't understand our history, our past, we can't shape our present. We're in a continuous state of denial. So what keeps me awake at night is that if we lose this opportunity, we stand to lose so much more, maybe everything that we care about.
Thank you.
I agree with Brooke, and I would add only that I am very fearful about the ability to vote itself. We've all been reading a lot about efforts to disenfranchise. We've also been reading about the long lines in Milwaukee. We've all read about the ways in which the US voting system and electoral processes are in many ways illiberal and anti-democratic. Within just a few years from now, I believe 70% of the American population, I believe, or a majority of the population will live in just 15 states. I happen to be lucky enough to live in California, which has the same Senate representation with 40 million people as Wyoming does with 560,000. But even more urgently than that is, will people be allowed to go to the polls? Will the mail-in ballots be counted in a timely and fair fashion? You know, it is often, especially as an opinion journalist, you know, we often think about outcomes, and I have a desired set of outcomes for November, but we also have to think about process, because I think the greatest enemy to the greatest source of erosion of our democratic values is if we no longer believe in the process, if people delegitimize their opponents as enemies, then you get that really would enhance the slide toward authoritarianism. And I think at some point, you know, this year, these past couple of years, I've tried to check my own, you know, political feelings, not because I don't have them, but because we have to stand for what's right. And we have to call out norm violations wherever they occur. I happen to think that this is not an equal opportunity thing. I think one party has violated the norms of our democracy and given in to authoritarian tendencies more than the other has. My friend Yasha Monk, who has written a lot about declining enthusiasm for democracy, really describes it as a global phenomenon. And that's really, in the end, what keeps me up at night, because Trump is probably going to be either president for zero more years or four. I expect that all of us will be here. I hope that most of us will be here in 20 and 30 years. And will our democracy have enjoyed a revival? Will there be a renewed interest in our institutions, higher levels of turnout, renewed commitment to democratic purpose and to solving problems? Or will we slide into an era of apathy, or God forbid, violence and severe unrest?
Thank you, Saul. I have a few questions actually from the audience, but before we move to those ones, I wanted to actually ask you about who do you trust? Who do you read? Who brings you peace? Who allows you to center yourself in the present and have hope in the future?
Do you want me to start? Well, I'll just try to be brief, I'm sorry. I try to read literary fiction and also history and nonfiction. I mean, for me, that's very grounding. I need to understand the past. I usually prefer books written by scholars and professional historians, because I really want a sense of what we know now about the past and to help analyze the present in light of what's happened. So, you know, I first read Eric Foner's Reconstruction 20 years ago and find it now more relevant than ever. I do try, especially since I tend to be liberal in my orientation, to read some conservative media. I don't have much time to watch television, so I don't watch either MSNBC or Fox. But I do get a daily email called The Writing, I believe, R-I-G-H-T-I-N-G, which is a sampling of right-wing media. I read the Wall Street Journal's editorial page every day. There's also a new news source that I'm forgetting the name of it, but it's factual reporting, but kind of from a conservative perspective. I believe Jonah Goldberg is behind it, and it's called The Dispatch. You know, one of our questioners, Rosalind Sepulveda, asks, how do you think you can reach people who don't read newspapers or serious magazines, don't watch the news, don't listen to NPR, and get their news from social media posts or biased or conspiracy websites and repost them? And I think that is just such a profound question. I don't have one simple answer to that. I have had conversations with people who say, you work for the New York Times or the LA Times, that's liberal bias. I don't trust it. I've responded calmly and said, well, one place you can get factual news with conservative opinion is the Wall Street Journal. Have you considered that? And I think just anything that kind of opens the curiosity gap and gets people to read things that are trusted, you know, we have to have a common basis of facts. Then we can debate the values. I feel right now we're debating, but it's really out of a place of ignorance.
Thank you.
So in terms of news that I read, having been as a child of Haitian immigrants, I've really been interested in international news my entire life, because to get really in-depth news about Haiti, you have to go to Haitian radio or Haitian newspapers. So I do that. I also read, of course, the New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post. I watch Fox News, MSNBC, PBS, obviously, NPR, I listen to. But I will say the other thing that I do, that I'm not quite sure if the news has brought me peace per se. I think when it comes to finding peace in all of this, I find myself doing, I'm Catholic, so I do devotionals. I also listen to a lot of music. I've been listening to a lot of Bill Weathers recently. And I think that I also read a lot of fiction books. So John Grisham's one of my favorite authors. So I think that that's kind of the way that I've been finding peace. But real peace in these times has not been, frankly, watching the news. It's been centering and being quiet and meditating, because all the stuff around us is just so chaotic.
As for me, I trust the information that has served me well in the past. I'm always skeptical, even of the finest journalism in the finest sources. But of course, I consume it. I need to know what's going on. I, however, do not check the news every 5 seconds. I disabled the notifications on my phone. I've been off Facebook for years. I don't feel that I've missed much at all. In fact, I think I've gained quite a lot by having some control over my time and knowing what's going on an incremental basis. I don't need to. I'm not a daily reporter. I understand that is necessary for some people. It's not for me. Nor do I feel particularly courageous, Sewell. That was nice of you to put me in that category. I sit behind a mic in my house and interview really fascinating people. I'm not out there in press conferences or at presidential events the way that Yamiche might be. I'm just here in Brooklyn. So I don't feel any, but it isn't that I feel a lack of distress. And I have to say that I talk to a lot of historians for the show, and I find that profoundly satisfying and soothing. I don't read that much history. To be honest with you, my reading for enjoyment is almost entirely science fiction, and always has been. And I know that makes me some kind of 13-year-old boy, but the fact of the matter is that I find busting out of my worldview with good, really good science fiction, and there's so much of it, is thrilling and a relief and not an escape so much as a kind of a journey into another way of looking at things. So I really recommend that genre for people who have dismissed it.
Thank you, Brooke. I live a few miles from where Octavia Butler actually grew up. So really? I highly recommend the genre and that particular author.
Spectacular.
Yes. Lily King asks, the video of George Floyd's murder, filmed by 17-year-old Darnell Fraser, sparked a worldwide movement against police brutality. What is the role of bystanders and eyewitness journalists in a rapidly changing media landscape, and how do you integrate their footage and eyewitness accounts into your reporting?
I think that that has been going on. I mean, a lot of that footage is being integrated into the reporting, and the role of bystanders is critical, particularly in the area of police misconduct and brutality or worse. It has been the way that we've arrived at this moment. And, back in the early days of digital media, everybody talked about the democratizing of media, everybody now owned a printing press and all of that. Well, now, decades later, we are seeing the daily impact of that. And it's important. It is the world not filtered through the eyes of a group that is privileged to have a big platform, and it has merged with that platform. It's a revolution, and it's vital.
I think bystanders have always been critical. You go back to the Rodney King beating and realize that it wasn't a journalist that filmed that. So I think for a long time, we've seen African-Americans in particular, but other people, we've seen them brutalized by the police on video. And that has been the thing that has impacted hearts and minds. I think that where the journalism comes in is that we can say that after Rodney King, after Eric Garner, after George Floyd, we haven't seen the system change according to Black Lives Matter activists, but also according to police officers. The system hasn't fundamentally been that different from Rodney King to George Floyd, really. So I think in some ways, there is this critical role that bystanders and these videos are playing. But I always think back to the fact that Eric Garner's mother told me, well, we watched my son beg for his life, say he can't breathe, and still we did not see any justice in the way that we thought we would see justice. So I also think that there's critical work that needs to be done when you think about journalists and the Washington Post and my friend Wesley Lowery having the counting of how many people are killed by police. I think that's the extra step that journalism can do. It can be telling those stories apart from this viral moment that is this one moment that, of course, in the case of George Floyd, really ignites people's and makes people go to the street. It's the consequences of that. It's how the system actually functions. It's the reporting around how police officers move from one department to another, even if they're fired, and all the things that go on in police unions. I think that is the critical other piece that goes hand in hand with bystander videos and all the things that we've seen.
Can I just say that I would mark the moment from Rodney King, but not exactly because it wasn't captured on a cell phone in a person's pocket in that way. It was back in 91. It was a long time ago. And the technology just didn't exist. And it was a long time from Rodney King to this moment. I couldn't agree more that the reporting around these images is vital. And not just vital, but more important to keep the push going. But it is the fact that there are eyes on the street, and yeah, we haven't seen a change yet, and Eric Garner's family didn't see a change, and how many do there have to be?
And I agree with you. I think, I mean, Rodney King was a camcorder, right? It was a new technology that was not in your pocket. Cell phone videos is clearly, we've seen a whole new plethora. You think of Facebook Live and the Philando Castile killing. I think that there's so many times as the technology gets better and better and better, people are able to document the same kinds of terrible events happening in new ways. I think the question becomes, how does the journalism and how does the system actually react to now what we see as evidence after evidence after evidence of the fact that African Americans are being killed in disproportionate rates?
And I guess we have to ask why this one video to ignite a worldwide movement, for multiracial movement for Black Lives Matter. Not that it hadn't existed for, you know, for years already. But the thing is that there must be a reason. And the problem now is sustaining, is creating a political movement to finally change things. I mean, it's so easy to believe that things can't change. I have to believe that they can. You know, that's just to you, Yamiche. I think you're probably thinking, but the fact is that at least all across the country, there was outrage. And my fear is that the outrage dissipates and what is easy, I won't say it's easy, but what is immediate going into the street won't translate into sustained engagement and action.
I think a lot of people have that same fear, that same idea that George Floyd, I mean, Ava DuVernay came on PBS and spoke with our anchor, Judy Woodruff, and she really broke down the video of George Floyd in a new way and had me see it in a new way, which is the officer has his hand in his pocket. He's looking directly in the camera. There are people screaming for help with George Floyd. George Floyd is saying, sir, I can't breathe, sir, being very polite, even to the end of his death, calling out for his mother. He's still trying to be polite and respectable to try to get his life back from this officer. So I think that all of those things, I think, make that video, of course, stand out. But I also remember the killing of Trayvon Martin and people being up in arms about the idea that a 17-year-old walking home unarmed could be shot by someone who wasn't even a police officer and what that meant to society. So I think that question of sustaining, that question of what does it actually take for the system to change, I think that is one that I think a lot of people, especially in a pandemic where people have hours upon hours to think and reflect, is something that a lot of people are wondering about.
The energy for change sometimes, and perhaps in every moment in our history, has been partly sustained by journalists. But journalism right now is, if I may say so, part of the problem. You have factions within journalism, competitors for the truth, if you wish. What do you think, from the questions of our audience, what do you think needs to be done to help journalists regain public trust?
That for us, or?
I think for the profession. How do we get over this echoing of fake news in our ears that has been repeated 10,000 times in the last 24 hours?
Well, I think one way is to stop the factions that are echoing it, which are emanating from the White House. I mean, fake news did have a meaning. It originally was a bunch of teenagers somewhere in Eastern Europe, usually, generating stories that were fake for clicks so that they could get advertising dollars. That's what fake news was. The president took the phrase and, as he does with so much, modified it for his own use until it was unrecognizable. When you say journalists are responsible, I hold journalists responsible for complacency and for not seeing things, not taking the situation seriously when it first unfolded. But when you say there are journalist competitors fighting each other, are you talking about real journalism, or are you talking about something that might call itself journalism but is clearly not? I think it was Steve Bannon who said, Don Jr., he's a fine fellow, but he believes everything that's on Breitbart. And Steve Bannon was the editor of Breitbart for years. So I don't know that I would grace every single producer of content as journalism, if what they produce is lies.
Hector, I would add, you know, the challenge of disinformation, information silos and echo chambers is very real. I do think journalists alone cannot get to the bottom of it. I think our education system needs to teach news literacy. I'm very struck that a lot of the people most susceptible to fake news actually are the elderly, because they came of age and they, you know, the onslaught of information in the last few years. I'm sure we all have parents or grandparents who've recently signed up for Facebook only in the last few years. You know, when my mom did so, it kind of terrified me a little bit, frankly, because I feel there's a lot of exploitation out there, but all, you know, in terms of fraud and stuff. But more importantly, you know, a lot of targeted right-wing messages and propaganda, it's become quite accessible. You know, I strongly believe that the giants have to move. I highly recommend the new Netflix documentary, A Social Dilemma, which is about the role of the algorithms and the ad-supported digital giants that have sucked up so much wealth, but more importantly, are really not the old line that we're not publishers, we're just platforms. you know, I don't think that's going to hold. I don't think the Europeans are buying that argument. I think there's going to be more regulation. I credit the companies. Some of them are saying that we need to be regulated. They are aware that they've become so big and so powerful and so dangerous that there may need to be a neutral framework to govern how they do business. I hope the ecosystem can rebalance. But it is a tough question. You know, I've talked to a lot of computer scientists and data scientists who say that kind of valid, you know, 5 years ago, there was a big move toward fact-checking, right? And it's still huge. God bless Glenn Kessler and the people at the Washington Post who chronicled, you know, Trump's 20,000 lies or whatever. But that's very, very hard to scale. And when you look at how much information is going on exchanging every day across the internet, you know, I'm sympathetic to a point that Facebook and Twitter, you know, they have a lot of moderators, but it's not enough. But the truth is, as someone said, I heard on radio recently, you know, you subcontract that which you don't value.
That was my show.
That was your show, Brooke. And that was really, really quite, you know, I highly recommend the latest episode of On the Media because, you know, it really is a question. Like, these have become de facto publishers or at least disseminators of content. They may not originate the content, but they are how our readers, our listeners, our viewers are often experiencing the content. And I think there has to be kind of a new compact. I'm not talking about driving these tech giants out of business. I'm talking about rebalancing the media ecosystem. 45% of local newspaper jobs in America have been wiped out since the Great Recession, 45%. So, you know, God bless institutions like the New York Times that have managed to find new business models and get to a place of economic safety. But what about the state houses, the city councils? Here in LA, how many of the 88 cities does even my publication, the LA Times, can we cover, even with a substantial staff? You have to think about journalism and the news as an ecosystem. And that ecosystem is going through a mass extinction event, a threat to biodiversity. We have to acknowledge that, and then we have to find ways to address it.
Thank you, Sir Brooke. Yamish, I think we are arriving to the end. I wanted to thank you for your words and your wisdom. I've been honored to be here with you. And right now, I believe we actually send this back to Jessica, who is going to be saying farewell. But to everybody who joined us today, thank you for joining us. Your participation matters. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Hector.
Thank you all. I'm really happy that you have had this incredibly provocative, fascinating discussion. Thank you, Sewell. Thank you, Shamish. Thank you, Brooke. And, you know, I'm really, and Hector, it's been a lovely and really fascinating, important discussion in this time during all that is happening. I want to thank all our members for being here this evening. And for all of you who are watching for the first time, please consider joining and seeing programs like this interesting one. It would be wonderful if you would go to the website, lfla.org/support. We hope you'll join us for our next program, which is October 14th, to hear Deborah Spar and Michelle Brachter-Goodwin in machines, technology, and how they shape our destiny. That will be on October 14th. I'm so pleased to have you all here this evening. Thank you so much, and take care. Have a good evening.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.